comments. So we should really take a look at the key piece to the story. The entire story hinges around one non-action, and that is Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman. If that doesn't happen, none of the story happens. Right? True, there's other things that are necessary. We have to have Vashti taken out of the way so that there's room for Esther so she can be in place. We have to have Mordechai working in the court so he can do his magic. But remember, if Mordechai bows to Haman or Mordechai is not a member of the court, so it's not an issue, none of this happens. No decree, and there's no war, and there's no problems, and you know, life goes on, maybe in a negative way, and maybe it needed to happen. But we got to figure out what was Mordechai's motivation for refusing to bow. Now, you could make the argument, just a priori, that Mordechai's refusal to bow was a personal issue, was a comfort issue, because he never really speaks up and says, why not? But that answer becomes impossible once you realize that, A, Mordechai is aware of the impact of his non-bowing, and Mordechai has a chance later on to rectify it, and he doesn't, which means there must be something very big going on. Let's take a look at the key passage, see what's going on, which is passage number one, which is the beginning of the third parak of Megillat Esther, and of course is every kid's final relief after two painstakingly long chapters in which Haman's name is not mentioned. Okay? We're not going to do our psychological profile of Haman, which is an interesting piece by itself, because that belongs to a whole different shiur. But Haman seems to come out of nowhere. We didn't hear about him before. We heard about lots of advisors, including the seven closest advisors to the king. Haman's not on that list, although, of course, famously, Chachamim say Memuchan say Haman, but he's not on the list. And now he's not only raised up by Achashverosh, but he's raised up to become the most critical and highest minister. Now, truth to be told, we were given that list of ministers in year 3, and now we're in year 12. So it could be some of them died in the meantime, some of them were disfavored in the meantime, some of them lied to Congress in the meantime. It could be a lot of things, and that they're no longer there, so there's room for him. But nonetheless, you would figure that he'd have some sort of a history at the court. We don't hear about it. So who's bowing to Haman? Who's bowing to Haman?
Everybody.
Not everybody.
Everyone who works for the king.
Everyone who works for the king in the king's offices. Meaning, you bump into Haman in the 7-Eleven, you can buy him a Slurpee, but you don't have to bow down, evidently. But you if you work in the palace and you're at your desk in your office, you got to bow down. Now, just to be clear, what does Koraim Mishtachavim actually mean? What is Koraim? Koraim is kneeling, which means you put your knees on the ground and you put your head on the ground. That's Koraim. What's Mishtachavim?
Prostrate.
Which one is it? Prostrate, right? Okay, you want to get it right. Right? Flat out on the ground, which may be included with the other also. But you're flat out on the ground, right? That's what everybody's doing. So imagine that you walk into the office and suddenly there's a little noise and everybody hits the ground, their knees on the ground, their head on the ground, then they're flat on the ground, and you know that Haman's are coming. Right? And why is that? Kichen tziva lo hamelech. How would you translate that phrase? Kichen tziva lo hamelech.
King commanded it.
Hmm?
The king commanded it.
The king commanded, what's the low part?
For him.
So for him. Can't be to him. It'd be kind of strange. Okay, so the king commanded concerning Haman that Eretz should bow down. Now, we're going to look at that command a little later, but let's follow the story. And we don't know why. Any suggestions as to why?
Can we assume that everyone bows down for the king?
We probably should assume that, of course, probably, although Mordechai probably never saw the king until later on in the story, right? In other words, who sees the king? We know that the inner circle, that's it. The king doesn't walk around, and the king of the Megillah, who is not the king of history nor the king of the Midrash, the king of the Megillah is not somebody who goes outside. That's actually part of our issue. So we would assume that everybody bows down to the king. Correct. Why doesn't Mordechai bow down? It's a mystery. Okay, so We'll examine some of the answers that have been given, because it's something that everybody's got to deal with. It's a core part of the story. And now there's two things that are strange that happen in the ensuing time. The other members of the court turn to Mordechai and say, why are you violating the order of the king? And Mordechai doesn't seem to answer. But which means this is going on for several days. It sounds like it's going on for a long time, but it's going on for several days. And he doesn't listen to them, meaning he doesn't do what they're saying. Now, first of all, why are they so interested in him bowing down? Is that what they're asking? Are they saying, come on, bow down? Or are they asking him an informational question? Like, what's the nature of their question? He doesn't give in to them. And then, vayagidu l'Haman, well, they go tell Haman. What do they tell Haman? What is it they tell Haman?
He's not
bowing, which is a little strange, because Haman should be seeing. Everybody else is bowing down with one guy standing up. So there's a couple possibilities that we can play with here, but let's just see the end of the pasuk, and then we'll come back to them. Vayagidu l'Haman, what's their motivation for telling Haman? L'ra'otayamdu divrei Mordechai, kigid lahem asher hu Yehudi. They wanted to see if Mordechai's words would stand. Now that's a little strange, because we don't have any words. We don't know what that means. But they wanted to see if Mordechai's words would stand. Kigid lahem asher hu Yehudi. He told them that he was Jewish. And that's something we talked about last week, which is that Mordechai's identity was not at all known, even to the people who he worked with day in, day out for years, and he told them he was Jewish. Right? But that motivated them to go and tell Haman. Now, why are they interested in doing this? So when I was a lot younger, I really thought that they were the real anti-Semites in the court. And they found out, oh, this guy's a Jew, we're going to get him killed, we'll go tell Haman he's not bowing down. Then I thought about it a little bit differently, and I thought, you know what, this reminds me of the junior high school I went to. I went to a junior high school that had a significant population of greasers and lowriders, and a significant population of other types. And every few weeks you would hear from behind the gym a kind of a rhythmic thing, you know, fight, fight, fight. And you come around and you'd see two people, usually guys, in the middle of a circle, and around them, like 50 people standing, fight, fight, fight. They want to see a fight until the gym coach, the PE coach, who was about 6 foot square, would come and separate the guys, and yeah, you knuckleheads, and like that. But I thought these guys just want some entertainment. So I figured, Mordechai's being obstinate, Haman is who he is, so we'll push him up against, we'll watch a fight. Well, a little older, I realized that that's entertaining, but I don't think that's what's going on. You think about that, if you are a member of the court, how do you feel about Haman?
Jealous.
Probably hate his guts. Who is this yachts out of nowhere to come up and insinuate his way into the court to the point where he's so big and we got to bow down to him? He probably hate his guts. Problem is, you don't have the guts to do anything about it. Here's Mordechai, who refused to bow down. So if you keep things the way they are, then nothing moves. But if on the other hand you can create a confrontation, then it's possible that Mordechai will win, Haman will lose, and you won't have to bow down to him anymore. So it could be that Haman's kind of the front man. Mordechai's kind of the front man. And so he's Lerotei Amduti very Mordechai. But again, what words of Mordechai, we don't know what they are. He gives them a sure who you did.
But it doesn't say that he told Haman to see what Haman would do to him.
Right. They just want to see would Mordechai's words stand. We don't know what those words are. That's exactly it. Right. And now, Vayar Haman came court Mordechai kor mishtachavelo. Now Haman sees he's not bowing. Vayimale Haman chema. Now, how could it be that Haman didn't see him bowing till now? So I think that there's two possibilities. There's three possibilities. Possibility one is, and I'm not a big fan of this, possibility one is that who is supposed to bow? Avdei HaMelech. But who is in Shar HaMelech? All sorts of people. Farmers who are coming to ask for their lease to be extended, and people who have complaints and stuff like that, plus the guys who work there. Who's supposed to bow? Avdei HaMelech. So when, according to that, when Haman walks in, or is brought in, not everybody bows. And he doesn't notice that Mordechai happens to be there every day. Possibility one. I don't like it either. Possibility two is that Haman is doing what many teachers do. And I don't think any of my colleagues would be happy to be compared to Haman, but that is when you're teaching a class, and there's a kid who is a student who is not doing what they're supposed to do, but you happen to know that there's good reason for it. There's something going on at home, the kid's been sick, or whatever it is, you turn a blind eye. And you can turn a blind eye so long as none of the other students pick up on it. I mean, I've had situations like this. The minute that other students say, hey, how come he gets to go out of the room, how come he gets to play this committee, whatever it is, you're done. You can't keep it up. And so it's possible that that's what's going on, that Haman turned a blind eye, but the minute that they told him that Mordechai's not bowing, he couldn't avoid it anymore. But that doesn't fit either, because Haman's reaction is, Vayimaleh Haman chema, he gets furious. It doesn't sound like, you know, now I can't do it anymore. It sounds like something new. So I'm thinking that maybe when he came out, he was brought out in like a sedan, and there was some sort of a curtain, and he probably didn't see everything very detailed. Now he took notice. Yeah.
I would propose a fourth.
Sure.
That, and I would also defend the second one. One that maybe the idea that maybe that Haman himself wasn't requiring that everybody bowed to himself, but that there was the idea of Haman. So whether he had images of Haman around, whether it's the court of the king or around the country or whatever it is,
right.
I think we tend to simplify this idea of Persia and so on, almost like a stage, you know, so when we think of it, we can encompass the whole view
right.
in our mind's eye, but it's a big country, it's a big city, big country. So wherever it may be, Haman could have had deities, idols, pictures of himself hung in many places, and at a certain point in the day or at a certain point when you pass them, you have to bow down to them. And then Haman hears that this guy is doing his passing.
So he comes and sees it for himself.
But it says Shir Sharmel.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So within the Sharmel, that's fine. Still, it's a big palace. You ever go to these palaces?
No, Sharmel means the government offices.
They're still huge.
Right.
They're huge. I was just in one, and it was 550 rooms. You think that these people are passing each other every day necessarily?
Okay, it's possible, but it seems to be a stretch to think that we're talking not just about the person Haman, but of some sort of image of Haman.
Well,
right?
So I understand.
Okay, so that was your fourth proposal?
To defend the second one,
yeah.
I would say, even more so, to use to follow on in your example of the classroom, you let it go, because if you make an issue of it, you're not going to make a huge issue of it, but by making an issue of it, it creates an issue.
Right.
But then when you address it, you have to address it. You have to really address it.
Good. And that's why I'm not throwing out number two. I'm going to put number four into the hopper also.
Why did you describe Haman as a teacher?
I didn't say I'm from his teacher. I just meant that sometimes when there is something going on that as a leader or whatever it is, you benefit from turning a blind eye and not paying any attention to it and letting the little insurrection go on. It's worth it rather than making a deal. But the minute that it's brought to your attention, you can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the model here.
It could even be that he walks as he walks through the palace, you know, he walks looking up and just expecting everyone does it, but he's intentionally not looking
right.
at anybody.
So it's another version of the sedan with the curtain, is that he's not looking, and then when they point it out, then he starts looking and he sees. Well, anyway, I think that he's blowing up means that my number two is not very good. But again, we don't really know. We don't have the information. And Arya, what you said is certainly possible also. One way or the other, he really loses it. And so he's not satisfied with killing Mordechai, because now he knows who Mordechai's people are. He's just so filled with anger, he's going to kill Mordechai's people. And again, in the Megillah, not in the Midrash, in the Megillah, Haman doesn't have a problem with Jews. He has a problem with Mordechai, and by extension, Mordechai's people. And that's why the emphasis of the text is, that's the issue. Right now, of course, we have turned him midrashically into something very different, and that's not our focus here. But the question again is, why doesn't Mordechai bow? And again, the entire story rests on this, because if Mordechai bows, or if Mordechai is not there, or Mordechai is not supposed to bow, any of those things happen, then this story doesn't happen. All right, so why doesn't Mordechai bow? So there are traditionally two and a half, we'll call it three, different types of approaches, each that has a bunch of variations to it. All right, what's the most common explanation you've heard about why Mordechai didn't bow to Haman? What? Something about Avodah Zarah. I'm going to call it the Avodah Zarah answer. And that's premised on the idea that you should do anything rather than do worship of Avodah Zarah. Yeah, we're going to get to that one too. Yeah, sure. So there's the Avodah Zarah type answer.
Mordechai wouldn't bow down to the king out of respect to...
So again, we don't have any information. We don't know. But we'd assume he would. So there's the Avodah Zarah type answer, which has three variations in Chazal. Okay, one of them is quoted by Rashi here. All right, Rashi, see it in source 2. Sha'asa atzmo aloha, meaning Haman announced he was a god. Right? Okay, version number 2, the Ibn Ezra quotes, which is also from the Midrash. All right, you'll do even nachon mashdaju Chazal, ki tzurat selam v'avodah zarah yuv gadavu al mitznafto, that he either wove an image of Avodah Zarah into his clothing or onto his hat. Right, and then there's a variation of that he wore a pendant that was Avodah Zarah around him. Those are all sort of variations of the same idea, that somehow bowing down would be an act of Avodah Zarah, and if that's the case, then you have to absolutely avoid it. The first thing to put on the table is this is an anachronism. It's not the only anachronism in Midrash Esther. Midrash Esther is filled with anachronisms, and they're deliberate. We've talked about them in the past, how issues that were real-life issues in dealing with the Roman court are put into the Persian court in Megillah in Midrash Esther. The idea of having Jews bow down to the local gods, either by trickery or by coercion, was a common trope in the Roman era. And the whole story with Chana and her seven children, or the woman and her seven children, is all part of that same piece. There's no record of anything like that in the Persian Empire. Like, the Persian Empire was very literally tolerant. And Koresh, after all, was the one who provided us with the materials to go back and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. They have no interest in us converting. That's just not on their platter. That's not what they're about. So you could say, well, Haman had a personal interest in it, but then why? And if you think about it, it actually detracts. Because if Haman's thing is all about power, which is why he gets so infuriated when Mordechai doesn't bow down, but if the whole thing is to bow down not to me but to an idol that I'm carrying, then I'm not gaining that power by people bowing down. That's the second problem. But there's yet a much more egregious problem here. Let's say that you work in an office, and the boss is goes on one of these weekends with his minister, and he becomes a born again, and he comes back, and Monday morning, this office you've been working in for 20 years, you see a huge cross in the entrance, and it's posted that all people who work here are obligated to kneel down, kiss the cross, and accept, et cetera, et cetera. You know, every morning when they start their work day. All right? So what do you do?
Call the ACLU.
Right, but what do you do? What do you do before the ACLU? What do you do in a non-First Amendment environment? What do you do? So you go to work, you don't do it, right? And then at some point you get called in the office, right? So what's your end game? You quit. You don't keep walking into a situation. And especially, let's raise the stakes. Let's say that your boss has now told you that if this continues on, we're just going to have to kill you. Right? That sounds like a Monty Python routine. But you would simply quit. So if every day there is Avodah Zarah coming into the court and you're faced with this problem, quit. What's the worst that can happen if you quit? The very worst that can happen if you quit.
You'll starve.
No, way worse than that. They'll kill you. So they'll kill me. But you got to remember that Mordechai finds out, we're going to look at it right now, what the impact of the decree is, the impact of his actions are, and he has an opportunity to fix it, and he doesn't. Take a look, please, for a moment at source 4. All right. Vayetze Haman Vayomahu Sameach v'tov lev. This is after the first party, the night between the first party and the second party. Haman is just on top of the world. Which means Haman comes out and he sees Mordechai not bowing, which means Mordechai has another opportunity. And this is, the decree is already in place. They've already had 3 days of fasting. This is And Mordechai knows all of the background to the story, as we find out in Perek Daled. So why doesn't Mordechai at that point say, I'm sorry, I didn't know, or just disappear, quit the court? But he stays there. There's one other problem, which is a huge problem, not a small one, with using the Avodah Zarah explanation. Let's say that somebody puts a gun to your head and says, either you accept, you know, the founder of Christianity as your personal Lord and Savior, or I'm going to kill you. So what is the halachic demand? Give up your life. Can anybody around this room say, I know what I would do? I don't know what I would do. But that's the demand is, right? We don't know until we get there. Hopefully we would never be in a situation like that. But let me switch the scenario a little bit. A guy comes up to you, instead of a gun, he comes up to you with an iPad. And he opens the iPad and he shows it to you, and there's a camera on somebody that you know vaguely, another Jewish fellow, who's in a room. And he's tied down. And just to dramatize this a little bit, there are two guys with hoods who have that kind of scarab or that kind of knife that, you know, the
scimitar.
A scimitar, right. Oh, right next to his neck. And the guy says, if you don't say the following formula in the next 10 seconds, then they're going to execute him. Now what do you do? What's the source for martyrdom? What's the pasuk that's the source that says that if you are threatened with your life, if you don't commit Avodah Zarah, you have to give up your life? What? That's as far as the murder issue goes. Oh, that's as far as stalking and other things of that sort, or saving your life. Correct. But I'm asking a different question. What's the source of the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem that if you're faced with Avodah Zarah or your life, you have to give up your life? It's pasuk, v'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha. I have to love God with your entire life, which means I have to show that my love for God is more important than my life. And therefore, if I'm going to have to betray my love for God, I would rather give up my life. Okay, beautiful. But do I have a right to give up his life to show how much I love God? I love God so much I'm willing to let him die? Let me change the stakes a little bit. It's not one guy in a room. The guy comes to you with another iPad and shows you a yard in which 400 kindergarten children are standing there. And they're surrounded by men with machine guns. And if I don't call this guy in the next 20 seconds and tell him that you've accepted Christianity, etc., then we're going to mow them all down. Now what? I'm just wondering, do you have a right to say no? I don't know. It's not so obvious.
Well, if you believe in God, God knows the difference between right and wrong, and God knows what an Avodah Zarah is, and it's a rock or whatever it is. I mean, I don't think you should give up your life, and I don't care what the rabbis say.
Well, okay, but we're operating within halacha. Okay. Within halacha, is it the appropriate answer to say you should stick to your quote-unquote guns and say, I'm not saying anything, and allow other people to be killed? And now we're not talking about somebody else. We're not talking about foreign kids. We're talking about the entire Jewish people. So it becomes difficult. Now, truth is that there are other answers that are given.
So what is there are
other answers that are given to this problem, but those answers are even more difficult. If you take a look, I'm going to show you one that's just delightful. I printed this out for you. In Targum Esther, Targum Sheni of Esther, there was a story which David is, I think, probably connected to the story that you mentioned. In which Haman and Ahasuerus, read it, I printed it so you could read it at home, it's very entertaining. Haman and Mordechai are both generals in Ahasuerus' army, and they're on a particular battle, and in that battle, Haman runs out of provisions, and he comes to Mordechai and asks him to give him provisions. Mordechai can't give him the provisions because he needs them for his own men. Negotiation back and forth. Finally, end of the story is Haman sells himself as a slave to Mordechai. And here you have the wording of it. The bill is there. I, Haman, they have the whole thing here. The nusach. And they don't think they're going to write it on, so they write it on Mordechai's leggings. And then every time that Haman walks out, Mordechai just lifts his thing, and he sees the leggings, and he becomes infuriated because Mordechai reminds him that he's a slave. Picante. It's beautiful. But please tell me, does it make any sense to say, I'm going to risk everybody's life because I'm not going to bow down to my own slave? Or I'm going to risk everybody's life because I'm not going to bow down to he's from Amalek and I'm from Binyamin or I'm from royalty of Shaul. All of the different types of answers that are given, and those are all variations of the same thing, which is it's about personal pride or about national pride or something else. All very fine until push comes to shove. And any answer that you give is going to still suffer from the same problem. Why are you staying in the palace? Leave the palace. And if they catch up with you and they kill you for leaving the palace, they'll kill you. But at least everybody else will live. You're endangering everybody else. It's very strange. So I'd like to suggest that there may be a different approach to take. If you take a look at the back page, you'll see that there is a phrase that's used in the description of Haman and the decree, that is a phrase that, and you can already see it bolded here, that appears in only one other place in Tanakh. But I have to give two introductions here, very quick introductions. Introduction number one, as you all know, Tanakh is scaffolded. Right? Earlier stories in Bereishit reoccur in different ways in later parts of Bereishit. Stories in Bereishit are referenced in Bamidbar and Dvarim. Stories in Chumash are referenced and alluded to in Yoshua and Shoftim and Shmuel. Whole pieces of Bereishit are hinted to and picked up on in Megillat Rut, etc. And the later you go in Tanakh, the more material there is to work with. By the time you get to Megillat Esther, there's tons of material to work with, and there's lots of allusions that are used in order to give us more information about what's going on just by kind of connection. That's number one. Number two is that Megillat Esther is also a particular genre of story, which is something we refer to as the motif of the Jew in the foreign court. The Jew in the foreign court, this might be the most famous example, but it's not the first one. What's the first Jew in the foreign court story that we have in Tanakh?
Joseph.
Right. And there's so many connections between the Yosef story and the Esther and Mordechai story. Mishnah LaMelech, right? And I think the Septuagint version, the dreams and all of that. And there's other connections you see at the very beginning of Perek Bet. In the case of there's a phrase that happens in the interaction between Mordechai and his co-workers. It appears in the Yosef story as well. Please take a look at the right side, source 9. Etc. And then in Pasuk Dalet, Vahikom Ramelav Yom Vayom V'lo Shama Alehem. So day after day, the servants are saying, why aren't you bowing down? And he doesn't listen to them, right? And the same, almost the same exact phrase, but we have nothing even close as anywhere in Tanakh, shows up in the story of Yosef and Mrs. Potiphar. All right, she says to him, lie with me. And he refuses. Yosef yom yom v'lo shama eleha. Just like you have v'lo shama alehem. Every day she's pestering to lie with her. Every day he doesn't listen to her. And then that whole scene happens. Now, maybe the author of Megillat Esther is using the same wording in order to say, if you want to know why Mordechai didn't bow, go look at the Yosef story. Okay. Why didn't Yosef lie down? They're both lying down. Why didn't Yosef lie down with Mrs. Potiphar?
Loyalty to his master.
Loyalty to his master. He says it. Take a look above, and it's in English also. Vayimain. All right, he refused. Vayomer aleshet adonav. Hein adoni lo yada itim ababayit v'chol asher ishto natan biyadi. My master, by the way, who's your master also, doesn't know of anything that's going on. He's entrusted me with everything. He's no greater than I am in this house. Sounds a little arrogant. He's held nothing back from me. You're the only thing he's held back from me because you're his wife. Important to note that Elohim within the Egyptian narratives, meaning the way we use it or the way it seems to be used, means general morality. Like, for instance, when the Mialdot, don't kill the Jewish kids, it says, Vatirana Mialdot Eta Elohim. Or when Safnat Paneach, who they don't know is Yosef, wants to tell the brothers he's not going to hurt them, he says, Et Elohim Ani Yarei. So it seems to be a statement for general morality. All right? How could I do this terrible thing? I would be betraying the trust. which means you and I both have a greater master. That's your husband, my boss. And he has entrusted me, and I would be violating that trust if I were to give in to your demand. And that's why I refuse to do it. Now, translate that into our case. Morph, Yosef, Mrs. Potiphar, and Potiphar. Who is that in our story? Mordechai? Who's Mrs. Potiphar? Haman. And who's Potiphar? Achashverosh. Mordechai is very simply saying, I can't bow down to Haman because Haman is not the king. It would be an act of disloyalty to the king for me to bow down to one of his ministers and treat him like a king. But I understand, didn't the king order it? Uh-huh. So there's one other thing we have to pay attention to in Megillat Esther. Again, Achashverosh of the Megillah is not Achashverosh of the Midrash, and neither of them is Achashverosh of history. But Achashverosh of the Megillah is presented as somebody who never leaves the palace. Not only that, he is absolutely ignorant of what's happening outside the palace walls. So is Esther. Esther has no idea about a decree to kill her people till she hears that Mordechai is walking around dressed like he is. Right? So if that's the case, then we have Achashverosh inside the palace. Where did this decree come from to bow down? And now look back at the words, Kichen tziva lo hamelech. Haman comes out and says, the king said, you got to bow down to me. What does Mordechai say back? I don't believe it. It's a lie. There is no such decree. And therefore, what's Mordechai doing? He's demonstrating his loyalty to Achashverosh by refusing to bow. He doesn't leave the palace because he has to stay there in order to demonstrate that loyalty. And why does it say, Ki gidlo ha'masher Yehudi? What's the relevance of it? It's not a religious reason. It's something else. Where is this happening? What city is this happening in? Shushan. Shushan is where the exile is shifted to, the capital of the exile. Right? But beforehand it was in Bavel. Bavel, Elam, Shushan. When the Jews were in Bavel, which is part of Bavel, when the Jews were in Bavel, meaning at the beginning of the exile, there were prophets in Yerushalayim who were sending the messages, which were, sit on your suitcases, we're ready to come back right away. Yirmiyahu sent them a letter, Perek Chavtet of Yirmiyahu. And the letter, he says, build houses, plant gardens, have kids, marry your kids off. You're going to be there for a while. You'll be coming back, but you'll be there for a while. And then he says the following line, V'tishu et shlom ha'yer asher igleti atchem shama. Seek the peace of the city that I've exiled you to. Ki b'shtoma yelachem shalom. When it's at peace, you'll be at peace. And Mordechai is simply saying, I'm a Yehudi, which means I know that message of Yirmiyahu, which means I know that a strong, stable government is in our interest. And being part of a revolution and being part of a coup is not in our interest. And by the way, historically, Jews have always suffered when there's a revolution. So I'm showing my loyalty to Achashverosh. What? The Jews weren't in a bad situation beforehand, right? But I'm saying, think about the Soviet Union as a great example. I'm a Yehudi, therefore I have loyalty to the king. And it's an act of disloyalty for me to bow down because I really know what Haman's after. Haman is actually trying to gain support so that he can overthrow the king. And by the way, Haman reveals that later on when he comes in the middle of the night to the king's chambers and the king says, what should I do for somebody I really want to honor? And Haman says to himself, must be me, and describes the coronation. So it's pretty clear what Haman wants. No surprises. And so Mordechai refuses to bow and refuses to move. And to get away, he has to stand there. And then the people want to see, are Mordechai's words going to stand up? In the end, what happens? What Mordechai has been saying the whole time is proven to be true, and Haman is killed as a traitor. Because the first thing is the king finds out he's a traitor, because when the king says, what should I do for somebody I really want to honor? Knowing Haman's going to think it's himself, Haman opens his mouth and describes the coronation. And the second thing is, Haman is now accused of trying to kill the queen. And the third thing is, when the king walks in, what does he see? Haman trying to kill the queen. Right there. And how is he killed? He's killed as a traitor. And by the way, what makes him a traitor? He built a gallows for whom? Mordechai, the king's only friend. It's clear he's trying to kill the king. I don't know if he's trying to kill the king, but he's trying to create power. So Mordechai's refusal to bow is really an act of loyalty, which, by the way, may have implications beyond what we could talk about here today. But it may indeed be, and that's why I put part of chapter 9 here, that the war that took place on the 13th of Adar was essentially a war between Ahasuerus's loyalists and the rebels. And the loyalists won. Which is why this holiday actually becomes an official Persian holiday signed by the Mishneh LaMelech of Persia as a holiday that must be observed forever. It's a curious turn of events. But if you think about it, the other answers that we suggest about why he didn't bow down just didn't seem to pan out. So, something to think about this Purim.